Hello and welcome to our podcast, Baby Baking and Kid Raising, hosted by Eliza Carr, a passionate midwife, mama and founder of Bump and Bub.
As well as Dr. Joseph Scroy, an obstetrician, gynecologist, fertility specialist, as well as a dad of three.
Together, we'll be discussing topics from fertility through to parenthood and the journey in between.
Each week, we'll be joined by inspiring guests to share their journeys through fertility, pregnancy, birth, and parenthood, as well as educational episodes from us, a midwife and an obstetrician. This episode is sponsored by Franjo's Kitchen. Welcome back to another episode of Baby Baking and Kid Raising. Today's guest is the lovely Liana, who is with us here in the studio. Liana is a Melbourne-based mama of three beautiful babies, all of whom are under 2 years old, which is my definition of a champion. Liana conceived her first son through IVF and then fell pregnant with twins spontaneously. In today's episode, we're going to discuss the juggle of three babies, her journey through fertility treatments with her first pregnancy, as well as your twin pregnancy. So to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, what you do?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for having me, guys. So my name's Liana and I'm 30 and I live with my husband, Nick. We've got a beautiful 2-year-old son. He's just turned 2. And then we've got our miracle twin babies, Sophia and Tommy, who are just turned 8 months. And I'm a property valuer on maternity leave, obviously, at the moment. So just, you know, being a mum and just enjoying it at the moment.
Being a mum to three little ones.
Yeah, trying to juggle and find a routine and all of that.
Yeah.
Who was born first, Sophia or Tommy?
Sophia, the girl. She's the boss.
We go Sophia and Tommy.
Yeah, that's why.
S&T.
I'm like, if I say Tommy and Sophia, then I'll get in trouble when I'm older because she'll be like, yeah, I'm older than him by 2 minutes. Yeah.
That's right, exactly. That's particularly important, I reckon.
Yeah, it is. And we were just saying before we started this podcast, it's currently 7:30 at night, which is amazing. You've escaped the bedtime and bath time routine, as have I, which is a very rare.
It is.
Feels like a treat.
7:30 is bedtime for them. Yeah. So from 5:30, we call it witching hour. Everything's crazy. They're having solids. Christian's eating dinner. Then we do bath for the three kids, and that's just a complete nightmare. You're trying to, you know, do two at once and then pass one to me, and then Nick does the other one, and oh, my God, it's full on.
Do you get much help?
Yeah. So I've got my mum, who's amazing, and my dad. My dad helps a bit, but it's, you know, my mum was pretty much there every day for 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, especially because Christian was so little. I couldn't be alone with the three of them because he was acting out a little bit. So, I do have help from my mum. Yeah.
And how old was he when your twins were born?
He was 17 months old, yeah. Wow. So he was just turning 10 months when I found out I was pregnant. Yeah.
And one of the things that always surprises me about twin parenting, you know, I often get the photos where I'm very fortunate that I can have the twins and one in each arm, but then I'll figure, how the hell am I going to get out of this? But have you worked out how you can get two babies in your arms and then get them off you?
I still carry both of them up the stairs.
Wow.
So when they were born, the week after we moved into a double story, and I still carry them, both of them upstairs, both of them downstairs. And when mum's over, she's like, should you really be doing that? Like, just do one at a time. But one of them, Tommy, he's already trying to walk. So he's super active. So I can't just leave him anywhere. So I've sort of juggled. It's a little bit, if anyone looks at me, they're like, what is she doing? She's going to drop one of them. But I've mastered. Sometimes I've had to have three of them as well. So
Wow.
Amazing. It's a sight.
So tell us a little bit about trying to conceive the first time around, because, of course, you know, having done IVF or having to do IVF is no mean feat, and people get to that point where they have to because of whatever variety of reasons. But how long had you guys been trying for? What were the things that you were doing in order to try to conceive in order to have your son the first time around?
Yeah, so we had got married and then I had decided to get off the pill. I was on it for 10 years. Didn't know if it was going to have an effect or whatever. So we decided to start trying, and I had sort of read and heard that, you know, at our age it was sort of going to take, you know, if it could take up to 12 months, and if it did, then maybe try and seek some help. Anyway, so there was no expectations at the start, but it was sort of just when COVID had hit. And so I had a lot of time. I became really interested in preconception health and all of that. Like, there was just so many podcasts I was listening to. I came across this American one called Tiny Feet, and they were talking about fertility and preconception care and things that I had just never heard about before. Mm. And so I started researching it, and I became really interested in like what you could do. Like, it just blew my mind that you could change your diet and remove certain things from your lifestyle, and you could create these healthy eggs and sperm, because I know that, you know, it takes 90 or 100 days for the sperm to, you know, replenish itself, and the same with the eggs. So I thought, if we can get our eggs and the sperm as healthy as can be, like, how cool would that be?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is important. I mean, I think a lot of people you shouldn't diminish that fact, because what you do in those first 100 days before you conceive has a lifelong impact in terms of that child when they're an adult. Yeah. And so we know that, for example, there are I've been on the morning show before talking about plastics and how plastics have these chemicals called phthalates in them, and they are hormone disrupting chemicals, and they can impair sperm production. They can impair, when a woman's pregnant, testosterone floating around to the boy, and boys end up with smaller penis sizes, for example. So there's lots of things that we can do preconceptionally to try to optimize our chances of, number one, becoming pregnant, but more importantly, having a healthy pregnancy, and more importantly, having a healthy child that goes on to become a healthy adult. Mm-hmm. And part of that is diet, Mediterranean-based diet, predominantly plant-based foods, very limited amounts of red meat, and in addition to that, reducing all the toxins, smoking. I'm still surprised many people smoke, but not smoking. And all those sort of things that, you know, we know intuitively they're the right thing to do, but, you know, and some people, you know, especially during the Christmas time, will get pregnant after a big night out. So, you can do that. Yeah. But I'm just saying that, you know, if you can put in the hard yards before you become pregnant, it is going to stand you in good stead.
Yeah, and that's what I had read. Like, in this podcast, I don't know, there wasn't really, my friends weren't really in the same life stage that I was, so I don't really heard about it or anything. But once I started researching, like Joe said, it was just crazy what we could do. Yeah. So, I mean, we already were pretty healthy and lived, you know, a balanced diet, but we changed little things. Like, I was like, well, you're not heating food up in plastic containers anymore, and you're not putting your mobile phone right in your pocket, you know, just let's be careful. And anyway, so we did all of that, and that, you know, I didn't go too crazy on it, but it was important to me. Sort of at around the 7-month mark, nothing was really happening. And I knew it could take to 12 months, but I was like, I'm just going to go to the GP anyway and just see what my options are. So I went to the GP, and she just suggested, go see a fertility specialist if you want. So we did, and they just ran the normal tests, a sperm analysis and blood tests for me. And everything generally came back okay. They just said with me I had quite a low AMH level.
I think it's important, because a lot of people do, as part of their fertility workup, an AMH. It's an anti-malarian hormone. It's a hormone that's secreted by, I think of them as seedlings, little seedlings in a sunflower box. I want you to imagine, I've said this on podcasts before, but when we're talking about ovulation, but rather than think about ovulation now, think about a flower box. And at the bottom, really, you've got a flower box. It might be like sort of 40 centimeters deep, full of soil. At the bottom, there are really small little seedlings. And as you sort of go through, if you could do a cross-section of the soil, you could actually see little seedlings in different stages getting bigger and bigger and bigger, until the very top you can actually see a flower blooming. The small little seedlings are called, they're like the small little follicles that sit in your ovaries, and they secrete this hormone called an antral follicle count. It gives us an understanding of what the underlying ovarian reserve of a woman is. Now, what this means, it doesn't actually predict your potential for pregnancy. So you can have a very low AMH, i.e. every month you might only have one or two follicles on your ovaries, but you ovulate every single month, and so you've got an easy chance of being able to get pregnant. Another woman who's got polycystic ovaries might have multiple little follicles sitting on her ovaries, but in actual fact never ovulate, so her chance of pregnancy is zero. So the AMH is not predictive of your chance of being able to become pregnant, but what it does do is it tells us, as fertility specialists, it guides us in terms of how much hormone we may need to give in order to produce more eggs during the cycle, or to collect eggs. Now, I liken that, for another analogy, as a fireplace. If you imagine you've got a fireplace, if your AMH is really low, let's say it's a little fire, it's sort of warming the room up a little bit, but not that great, we might have to whack on a massive log to get the fire to work. And so we put on a big log. Whoa, beautiful. It turns into a nice fire. The room's now nice and warm. But another woman who's got a really high MH might already have a big fire roaring. Mm-hmm. And if we go whack on a massive log, we're going to cause a massive bonfire. It's going to burn the house down. So then what we need to do is say, okay, you know what? Your fire's pretty good. We're just going to put on a little log. And so it guides us in terms of our dosing of medication so we get the right amount of medication that gives us just the right amount of stimulation to collect as many eggs as we possibly can within a safe limit. So we want to collect, generally speaking, with an IVF cycle, ideally somewhere between 8 to 15 eggs. And so that's what the AMH does. A lot of women will want to go and do the test because they think that that has a relationship to their fertility. It doesn't. The best time that you can get pregnant is when you're physically, financially, socially, emotionally, and medically ready to do so. And of course, that's never going to be the right time, is it, if you wait for all those five things? So the sooner the better, basically.
Yeah.
But anyway, you got the AMH done.
Yeah, so that's what the fertility specialist exactly said. It doesn't change whether you can fall pregnant or not. It's just something also to think about. Like if you were older, we might say, hurry up a little bit. But for me, we always wanted a young family, and also my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 32. Wow. And it's something, we've got the BRCA1 gene in our family, and it was something that I was just like, back then they had kids, you know, younger. So her family was done, but I was like, my family's not even started. So I was a little bit scared of that.
Do you have the BRCA gene?
I'm the only one in my family that thankfully doesn't.
Wow.
But that's a whole nother story. That, you know, the guilt that I carry that I don't have it and the rest of my siblings do is really difficult.
BRCA is the breast cancer gene. A lot of people will know about that. There's two different types, BRCA1, BRCA2. They relate to the gene, but they also are the timing of when you will get cancer or potentially get cancer. Not everyone gets cancer, of course. Mm. But, of course, it does predispose women to breast cancer. It predisposes men to prostate cancer and also to breast cancer as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things you can do if you do have the BRCA gene or you know that there's a strong family history of breast or ovarian cancer, because those two go together with the BRCA gene, is go and see a fertility specialist. And you can actually undertake something called IVF with pre-implantation genetic testing. So this is where we test the embryos to see whether we can create an embryo that doesn't have that gene and therefore stop the cycle of having cancer in the family. And so that's one thing that we can do, because you have two genes, we have two chromosomes. One chromosome will be normal and not have the BRCA gene, and on the other one it'll have the BRCA gene. So if we can give, I think about genes as almost like they're factories, right? So you've got two factories. One has got the BRCA gene that causes cancer and the other doesn't. It's a normal factory. It's producing no breast cancer, right? Or ovarian cancer. If you have the factory that produces breast cancer, it'll always produce breast cancer. But you've also got the other factory that doesn't produce breast cancer. So if you can pass on the factory to your child that has the factory that's got no breast cancer, then that's the factory that we want to select for your child, so your child doesn't have the BRCA gene, and then we end the cycle of it needing to be concerned about cancer. And, you know, you're right, there is guilt, but it's not your fault.
Yeah.
It's just the way the chromosomes crumbled, so to speak.
Yeah, it is. And it's even in, like, on my mum's side, because it was actually her dad that carried it.
Wow.
And my grandmother actually passed away from cancer, but a completely different cancer. But all my cousins have it as well.
Wow.
And my cousin and my uncle who have the gene got testicular cancer.
Yeah.
And now they're now researching into my family and the links and stuff, because there's not
testicular cancer, it's prostate.
Yeah. So they're actually doing some research and stuff on that. But anyway, because of all of that in the background, the fertility specialist just said, like, let's just start with ovulation induction. We'll do, you know, 3-4 months of that and see how that goes. So the first one was with letrozole. That didn't work. And then we moved to the gonal-F pen. And so I was doing injections, and I think we did about 4 months of that and nothing was happening. And so she sort of just said, like, you know, it hasn't really worked. I think the best step is to move into IVF, which we did. So then we moved into IVF, but at the time it was COVID as well. Mm. So every single fertility appointment was by myself.
Mm.
It was horrible. So I went on to do an egg retrieval, and that was just horrible. Like, Nick dropped me off there and then had to pick me up. I had to go in by myself, and it was, I already wasn't really dealing with it. You know, I just wasn't I'd never thought I'd have to go down that path. So I was a little bit like, oh, I don't have my family and Nick and, you know, my support network. But we ended up doing that and they got 12 eggs, which was pretty good. They sort of said to me, I can't remember what the average was, but they said you would lose a few between now and the fertilization stage. And then the next stage after that, you might lose a few more. Yeah. So I think all up, I lost 4. So they froze 8.
Wow.
Embryos, which I was quite happy with.
Well, that's actually very good. It's we normally would say if you get collect 10 eggs and all of them are mature, 60% of them will fertilize and maybe 2, possibly 3 will make it out to, it depends on your age, of course, would make it out to day 5 when we can suitably freeze them.
Yeah. Mm. So I was pretty happy with that and I was, I don't know, in my head I was like, kids. It's all the pre, yeah, they're still frozen, they're somewhere here. I was like, oh, you know, the preconception health, that, you know, maybe that helped, you know, my eggs, the quality, who knows. But I was so overstimulated that I couldn't actually go straight into a fresh embryo transfer. I was really, really unwell. So that was a bit disappointing. But then we moved into a frozen cycle maybe 2 months afterwards.
So just to explain that, so people will go through a stimulation cycle. This is where we've talked about on many podcasts where we give super fertilizer and a hydroponic system to grow all the seedlings up. Listen to the previous podcast. And we collect all the eggs. But unfortunately, some women can get something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. This is where the ovaries secrete a hormone that actually causes a leakage of fluid from the arteries that allows protein and fluid to go into what we term third spaces. So it can go into your lungs, it can go into your belly, make you feel really bloated, become dehydrated. And of course, if you were to become pregnant, it continues the cycle. The ovaries continue to secrete this hormone and you become really unwell. And very rarely, women can come exceptionally sick and need to go to ICU for it or HDU for it, so intensive care. So we're very conscious as fertility specialists, number one, not to overstimulate the ovaries, although 12 eggs isn't necessarily overstimulating. But some women are more susceptible to it than others. And then the other thing is if we're at the point of wanting to put an embryo in and a woman is unwell, bloated, putting on weight, can't breathe, nauseated, vomiting, we won't do a transfer. And those embryos will be frozen. Unfortunately, those embryos can be frozen for a lifetime, really. I mean, you could, technically speaking, donate your eggs to your daughter in the future, Sophia. So, or embryos rather, in the future. But the reality of the situation is you can come back and thaw that embryo out in another cycle and transfer it, and it's got a very good success rate, as equal to a fresh embryo being transferred within the same cycle.
Yeah, and that's what we did because, like you said, I was very unwell, bloated, I was so sick. And so we did a frozen embryo transfer. And unfortunately, that one didn't work. And I just remember, I think I had done some reading saying, you know, the first one probably won't be successful or whatever. But I just was devastated because that, for me, was like the closest I was to being pregnant and then losing it at the same time.
Yeah.
And so that felt like a massive loss to me. And it was really hard for me to explain that to Nick. Like, he was upset as well. But it just felt like I had lost this embryo, like, you know, and I created it and all of that. Yeah. But then we ended up moving into a second one. I think maybe we did 2 months break and then another one, and that was Christian.
Wow.
Yep. So
isn't it phenomenal what a woman goes through as well? Like, even just this discussion, your body went through an astronomical
crazy
amount.
Yeah.
Do you take a photo of Christian when he was a little embryo?
Yeah. He's like a little tiny line, and I can't wait to, when he's older, be like, this was you.
That was you.
You're a grain of sand once upon a time.
Crazy.
It's amazing.
Even literally, when they bring it out, like, they show your name on the screen and they're like, just, you know, confirming this is you. Yeah. And, yep, that's me. And then they bring it out on this stick. I don't even know what they, that's not what catheter. It's called, but catheter holding this little thing that you can't see.
It's
crazy.
It is. It's an amazing experience, really. I mean, I get to do this every day.
Yeah.
And I get to do 2 or 3 embryo transfers every day. And it is quite unbelievable that you, like, and for me, actually, the most wonderful thing is to be able to put an embryo in and then be, you know, humbled and privileged enough to be able to see that embryo as a baby when it comes out sort of 9 months later. It's quite bizarre.
It'd be pretty special.
Yeah.
It's literally miraculous.
Yeah, it is.
Like, when you really think about it, it's
science,
and
IVF,
right?
Like, is miraculous. I mean, it's miraculous, fortuitous, heaps of accidental discoveries that eventually get us to where we are now.
Mm.
So Christian, hey?
Christian, yeah, our little miracle baby.
Yeah.
IVF, Bubba. you weren't planning, obviously, to get pregnant again so soon after, I'd imagine, because obviously you thought, oh, my God, I need to do IVF.
Yeah, well, we thought we'll start. This is going to sound silly, but we were both in, my brother was getting married and my brother-in-law, and we were both in the bridal party for both weddings. Mm. And my brother-in-law's wedding was in Sydney. So we were sort of like, we want to get pregnant because we don't know how long it's going to take, but we sort of need to plan to make sure I can fly to Sydney and still be in the bridal party and then also be in the bridal party for my brother. So we're like, we'll try maybe for about 4 or 5 months. And then if that doesn't work, we'll just jump into another transfer, because I was like, I'm not going down that rabbit hole again of trying. And so we had a Fiji trip booked, and we're like, do we do the transfer beforehand? Do we not? Anyway, we're just trying naturally, and then went to Fiji, and there's this drink carver over there. Oh, I don't know if you know about
it. It's becoming popular. Well, it's not legal here yet, but it's becoming popular. Yeah.
And we go to Fiji every year. We love it. And my husband said to me, I want to do a carver ceremony. So we met with our friends, the locals, and his name was Joe, and he named Nick the chief of the ceremony because Nick had never tried it before. And so he said to Nick, oh, if you drink this, you'll fall pregnant with twins. And I leaned over to my husband and I started laughing because I was like, oh, joke's on him. We need science. But I'm actually ovulating, so that would be funny. And so we came back and we met with our fertility specialist, and she had said, your period's due next week. Start your injections on the Monday when you get your period, and we'll go into another transfer. And on the Sunday before, I woke up and I had the strangest dream that I was pregnant. So I was like, I'm going to do a test. So I did a test, and it was the faintest line ever that I thought, like, am I seeing things? And I just didn't believe it, because I was like, we needed IVF the first time, and, you know.
He's drunk the carver.
Yeah. So I called the fertility specialist the next day, and I'm like, I don't know what to do. Like, she's like, just, I'll give you a slip, go and do a blood test. So I did the blood test, and it came out with a HCG level of 10, which was like nothing. And so, but I'm like, but it's, you know, coming up. And she was like, let's do one for the next like 4 days. So it was slowly going up, but she said it might have been an ectopic pregnancy. Mm. So then I was like, oh, you know, here we go.
Why would that have happened with twins, such low HCG?
No, it's like,
I think it was early.
It was too early.
It was too early. Could it have registered because there was twins and,
a bit
like,
early.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think I must have only been like 3.5.
You would have been. So basically, when you have missed a period, which is 4 weeks, so for most women will have a 28-day cycle. So from the time that you've ovulated to the time that you would expect a period is generally speaking 2 weeks, 14 days plus or minus a couple of days. On that day that you have missed a period, generally speaking, the pregnancy hormone will be around about 150 to 200. That's what we like to see. And then it'll steadily increase every 48 hours by double. Now, if obviously you're testing before that, you'll pick up a small amount of hormone very early. Mm. And it may not follow that same doubling rate until it finally gets to the 4 week mark, and then it starts doing what it needs to do. So you'd obviously picked it up very early.
Yeah, it was very early.
With a dream. I'm always astounded by people who have these dreams.
I know. I sort of do that a bit often, and that's, you know, dream of something and it comes true. But
that's a lot of numbers.
Yeah, I wish. I'll tell you after this, you know, when we start recording. Yeah. But
who's going to win the grand final next year?
To say Melbourne. You know, actually, funny story, we're mad Melbourne supporters.
Yes.
And Christian was born when Melbourne won the grand final. Right. And we named, well, he was already going to be Christian. But everyone's like, you named him after Christian Petrarca. Yeah. And yeah, so funny.
I have to talk about football in this podcast studio, because this is where they do a lot of podcasting for footy.
So do you want me to say Carlton's going to win?
Definitely. Yeah. I love you to wake up in the middle of the night and go, Carlton!
Oh, awesome. I was, you know, wanted you guys to, you know, make Absolutely. It so badly. But
after we beat Melbourne, though.
Yeah, well, that's not okay. Yeah.
But anyway, so you thought, I'm pregnant, but you didn't think you had pregnant with twins.
No. Yeah. I still didn't even believe I was pregnant. But then after like the fourth or fifth day, it rose. And they were like, you're pregnant. So I called Nick and I was like, dude, we're pregnant. Like, what? Like, so confused. Anyway, still had no idea it was twins. And about 2 weeks later, we went and saw our OB, and we went in for a check. And I had quite a difficult pregnancy with Christian. They told me I was going to lose him. So I was quite petrified to go into this scan. Mm. And I was just like, please, you know, be a heartbeat. And I remember the OB just saying, he's like, good news. And we said, oh, please, there's a heartbeat. And he said, there's two. And Nick was a bit further away from me. And I never nervous laugh. I was nervous laughing. And I can't swear on this podcast, but – Nick started swearing at our OB. Don't know. Oh, it was just crazy. And we just walked out.
It's going
into
panic mode.
Yeah, like what? Because then I started thinking about the Carver thing and I was like, that is just nuts. Like, and my mum, it was her dream her whole life to have twins.
She
never had twins, but she was like, oh my God, how cool would twins be? And yes. And then when we found out it was twins, we were just shocked, like utter shock.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by Franjo's Kitchen. You may or may not know that me, yes, your favourite podcast host, don't tell Joe, now owns the phenomenal company that is Franjo's Kitchen. It's certainly been a very busy time. Business and motherhood are a wild roller coaster together. Franjo's Kitchen is Australia's original and number one brand for pregnancy and lactation cookies, as well as motherhood hydration powders. Our entire range is created and endorsed by health professionals across the nation to nourish and nurture you throughout the wild journey that is parenthood. From our delicious choc chip lactation cookies loaded with really beautiful ingredients like chia seeds, oats, flax seeds, and the most delicious Italian dark chocolate ever that help boost and support your milk supply, through to our thirst-quenching mixed berry or blood orange motherhood hydration powder created to hydrate, boost energy levels, and give you a good dose of vitamin C, antioxidants, and calcium at all stages of motherhood. Hydration is so essential at all phases. So if you're struggling with nausea in pregnancy or you're exhausted from a toddler who hates sleep, like mine, then this product is for you. Our products are all Australian-made, plant-based, and contain only natural ingredients that are actually good for you and work with your body. Oh, and we have a gluten-free range too for all of our beautiful gluten-free mamas. I wanted to give you all a sneaky discount code for those of you who listen to our podcast. So simply use PODCASTFAM for 15% off your entire order. Click the show notes below to find out more.
I've got a funny story about twins. I remember there was one lady and we'd done ovulation induction and there were two follicles there. So I always warn people when there are two follicles that there is about a 5 to 10% chance of having twins. Mm. You can trigger, but just know that that's the case. And this woman said, look, Joe, I've been trying for so long. Of course, you know, it doesn't matter. Well, you know. Anyway, so 2.5 weeks later, we're doing a scan, or a bit more than that, really. 4 weeks later, we're doing a scan. And the same sort of thing. I said, there's one little heartbeat and there's another. And she went, oh, holy F. She went, holy F. How the hell am I going to afford school fees? That was the first thing she said.
Oh, my
like,
God.
But she was like, the F word was like really, really loud.
That's what my husband said to the OB. Like it was the second time, you know, that we had met him and he said, F off. Like, and I'm looking at him like, oh, my God. And there was a student training in the room as well. And so, like, it was just so quick and like, oh, my
but
God.
Also because your brains or your mentality had been like, we're going to need help again.
Yes.
We've got these embryos. We'll have to do the whole process again.
Yeah.
You'd lost one embryo. You know, your mind is so set on that. And then to
so
have
set.
Twins is wild.
I'm still like in shock.
Still in shock.
People are like, how have you had twins? And I'm like, I don't know. Like,
it's a blur.
I really don't know. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So obviously, and it settles in. And when did it, I mean, obviously you saw twins on the first scan, but when does it actually sink in that, oh my God.
It hasn't sunk in for her yet.
Hasn't really sunk in.
But during that whole process, like when do you sort of realise, oh my God? And did you reach out to any people that had had twins before? Any support groups? What did you do?
When did it sink in? I reckon it must have been honestly when I was past 30 weeks.
Hmm.
Like I think I struggled connecting with Christian when I was pregnant because they said I was going to lose him. So then found out it was twins. This is a very negative way of thinking, but I was like, they're not going to survive. Mm. You know, like I know twin pregnancies are more complicated than a single pregnancy, so I was already a little bit scared. So I didn't really connect to them. So that's probably why I didn't really want to acknowledge that there was two in there, as horrible as that sounds.
No. What was the issue with Christian's pregnancy?
So with Christian, they told me, Melbourne IVF called me when I was exactly 4 weeks, said, good news, you're pregnant. And then when I was 5 weeks, I was just about to head out to work and I felt like a massive gush. And I went to the bathroom and there was blood everywhere and clots and everything. And so when I had called the fertility specialist and the nurse spoke to me and she said, like, I'll be honest with you, it's probably not a viable pregnancy. So put your feet up. I know it's hard to relax, but relax today and tomorrow, come in and go in for a scan. I hadn't even been in for my 6-week scan yet because I was very early. So then went in for the scan, and they said to me that I had a huge subchronic hematoma right above the baby. And so they said to me that it was quite large, I was bleeding a lot, that I was basically go home and stay on bed rest because you don't want to have a miscarriage while you're working or at the gym or anything, because I was going to lose him. So that was the problem with him.
Yeah. Just to explain, a subchorionic hematoma, so as the embryo sort of implants into the sidewall of the uterus, it's got all these little blood vessels. Obviously, it's trying to connect with mum in order to share nutrients. Those little blood vessels are very friable. They can break very easily. And so what you can get is like a bruise that forms around the sac where the baby is, like the amniotic sac. We call that a subchorionic hematoma. You can bleed a lot from them. I've seen a woman actually have a water bottle, like, you know, a 500ml water bottle full of blood very early on in pregnancy, and in actual fact go on and have a healthy baby. So understandably, the nurse was probably trying to, I always say to people, try to be cautiously optimistic. Yeah. I never like saying to people it's to do or die sort of situation. It's like, look, we need to be realistic that there could be something going on, but I want you to be cautiously optimistic that everything's going to be okay, because the reality is everything was okay with Christian
everything
in the
was,
end,
yeah.
Right? But there's not much you can do. Now, depending on if you imagine the circumference of the whole circle of the gestation sac, the one that we're really worried about is when it's more than 25% going around the whole circle. That's something that we tend to get a little bit more worried about. But you can have a small little, you know, bleed that's only 10%. That's okay, right? One of the things about it is like having a bruise on your skin. Like if you punch yourself on the thigh, if you've ever had a corky, you'll feel that bruise. Have you ever one?
Yeah, I have. Don't give me one.
Yeah. You get a bruise that forms there. That bruise over a period of time will resolve. It'll get absorbed by the body again. And the same thing can happen with a subchorionic hematoma. As that baby is growing, the hematoma behind it will be reabsorbed and the pregnancy can be ongoing. Unfortunately, in some cases, though, a lot of bleeding can cause the baby to pass away, unfortunately. Yeah. But the most important thing is, rest. I tend to give my patients progesterone and high levels of it in order to keep, we talk about this being a threatened miscarriage in medical terms.
Yeah.
We know that progesterone can potentially reduce that chance. And then just do weekly scans. And anytime you're worried, if you're having a further bleed, you go back to the obstetrician or you go back to your GP, get another scan done just to make sure that Bubba's okay.
Yeah.
Apart from that, the pregnancy with Christian was fine.
Yeah, it was okay. I mean, I was very, very sick up until 22 weeks. And so that was hard because I bled for almost 4 months.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was pretty much on bed rest for a lot of it. And I had really severe nausea, so that did not help that I was just lying in bed also. So that sort of resolved. I had, just the normal stuff, really bad back problems. And then I was having extra scans. So I think we had a scan at 30 weeks and they had said that we had low fluid around him. So that was just something that we had to then, do a scan every week and just double check. And from 34 weeks, the movements had completely dropped off. So they were just monitoring me very closely. I was in hospital like every couple of days, with the CTG monitor on. And then at 38 weeks, they decided to do an induction.
Being Barbara to the world.
Yeah.
So the twin pregnancy, everything presumably was okay to begin with. We know that there's increased chances of diabetes, high blood pressure, needing the babies to come out early or preterm birth. What were some of the things that were happening in terms of the pregnancy with the babies, like their first scan, the NIPT? Was that all that sort of stuff okay?
Yeah, everything was fine. I was having extra scans because it is a little bit more complicated, and I was so nervous, but everything was actually tracking really well. The NIPT was fine. And
did you find out the sex?
We did. We knew. We actually told people that we didn't know, because we had people just saying, "Well, we really wanted you to have a girl," and we just didn't want that pressure and, some comments. So we told our immediate family, and that was it.
And did you tell them you're having twins?
We told them twins, yeah. As soon as I left the OB's office, I called straight away and FaceTimed mum, and I was like, here's one ultrasound picture and here's the other. Like, I couldn't even wait till I got home because I was still laughing, like, oh, my
God.
Can
I tell you another funny story?
Yeah.
Cool trick. One of my patients, she wanted to trick her husband. So she said, can you take two photos that are different of the same baby?
But it wasn't twins.
It wasn't twins.
Oh, that's cruel.
That is so cruel.
Oh, my God. You better tell him afterwards.
No. Oh, that's crazy. Well, I took them everywhere with me because no one believed us. But, everything was okay. I just got really bad pelvic problems very early on. Mm. And like I just was all stomach. So that was hard to carry. But then I think when I was 32 weeks, I was diagnosed with preeclampsia, which I actually had with Christian, but they only told me on the day that I was induced. So they, one of the midwives, you know, was doing all of the normal tests before they broke my waters, and they said, oh, so you're being induced because you've got preeclampsia. And I was like, what? What do you mean? Like, I didn't even know. So that came on, you know, my OB knew about that, and it was being monitored. I was already taking aspirin and other medication to try and prevent that, but it came on, I think, at around 32 weeks. But for me, it wasn't severe that I had to have the babies early. Mm-hmm. It was just at 35 weeks, my waters had ruptured. And 2 days before that, I was leaking a little bit, but I just said, I was telling mom, and she's like, go to the doctors and, you know, go get a scan. And I was like, I'm seeing them in 2 days. It's fine. Like, I, you know, not that they ever, you know, said I was a bother, but I just didn't want to put them out. And I was like, it's fine. It's probably just discharge or whatever.
For anyone listening, call.
Yeah,
call the midwife.
Don't do what I did. That's very, very negligent. Anyway, so then I went in for my normal routine monitoring, and I had said to the midwife, I had said, just letting you know, think it's nothing, but maybe you should check. She's like, yep, no problem. So they called the OB down. I think he was doing a C-section. And they did a test, and he said, oh, it should be okay. Looks like a lot of discharge, but, you know, just call me if it turns positive. So I was like, all right. In the meantime, I've got Nick texting me, how's the appointment going? And I'm like, yeah, it's going fine. And then the midwife walks out, and she's like, it's positive. You're going straight up to birth suite. And I was like, what? Like, what do you mean I'm going straight to birth suite? So anyway, apart from waters rupturing early on, I was then on antibiotics and all of that in the hospital.
So just to run through this, so this was preterm. A ruptured membrane.
Yes,
so
preterm.
Before 37 weeks, when your waters break, we call that preterm. Mm. Now, sometimes we do, when we look at the, there's lots of secretions in the vagina. Normally, the secretions in the vagina are very white. They're like a claggy sort of substance. It's almost, and we call it leucorrhea, which basically means white discharge.
Yeah.
And anyway, so often there'll be a lot of white discharge. Now, if you're having a small little leak of fluid, that'll mix with that white stuff. So if it comes out in a bit of a, you know, more than what you'd normally like, most of the times we'll check to make sure that the waters are broken or not. If we think we're not 100% sure, we're not really sure, we use this thing that's called AmniSure. Funny enough, it's called AmniSure because it's wanting to see if there's any amniotic fluid. So okay. Are you sure there's not any amniotic fluid?
Yeah.
And we use that because then that tells us if the waters definitely are broken or not. So there's obviously clear-cut cases where you haven't broken your waters, and then there's clear-cut cases where you have, and then there's these, I don't know, I'm not sure, sure.
Yeah.
And that's where we use the AmniSure. If it comes back
and you
positive,
want to be sure with 35-week twins.
Yeah, it wasn't obvious to me. Yeah. Like you said, it was just like maybe runnier discharge than normal, but I was like, I'm towards the end of pregnancy. It's a twin pregnancy. Mm. It's probably
correct.
Nothing.
So your OB did the right thing, had a look, took a swab. And that came back positive. So the thing that we get most worried about then, particularly in relation to twins, but any birth really, any whether it's a single or a twin, is the fact that there can be a rising infection from the vagina. Because now what you've got is a vagina that's got lots of bacteria in it and an amniotic sac that potentially has now got a breach in it that can allow the bacteria to climb, particularly into the first twin that was presenting, and then precipitate you going into labor earlier. So what we tend to do in these scenarios, one of the things that we can do is give antibiotics to prevent that infection coming and obviously hopefully delay the onset of labor. So going into hospital, antibiotics, the right thing to do.
Yep. And that's what happened. I went straight up to birth suite and I had called Nick and I was like, so the appointment didn't go as planned. I'm not coming home. And he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, you know, my waters have ruptured or whatever. So he didn't understand what was going on. I'm just like, get my phone charger, get me some clothes. I'm going straight there. So he met me there. And then within like an hour, I started getting these contractions. Mm. And I was like, what is going on? Like I was honestly fine before that. But on the monitor, I was having CTG before that. And I was getting quite a few Braxton Hicks so they could see them. And within like an hour, things had just ramped up and they were coming on like every minute and a half. Like I could still talk and stuff, but I was like, this is not giving me a break and I'm uncomfortable. So they came in, they called the OB and they were like, try a shot of morphine. And as soon as I had that, then everything just sort of settled down and then fizzled out. But while I was in hospital, that happened two or three times.
Oh, wow.
Where it would sort of ramp up and then just stop. And every time I was like, am I going into labor? Like, am I not? So, yeah.
So did you stay in hospital from that point?
Well, I stayed in hospital pretty much. It was about a week, maybe 7 or 8 days. And then obviously I've got Christian at home who was quite young. And so that was really difficult because my husband was still working. He was coming in to see me, but it was very short visits and it was very hard. So
showed him to a toddler.
Yeah, my OB knew that I wanted to get home and he said it was safe. You know, we did all the blood tests and I was having monitoring. So I had finished my course of antibiotics. So he had said, it's fine to go home, but we're going to ramp up the care. Like I was, you know, I think a week and a half out anyway. Go into the office every 2 days, more monitoring, all of that. So I went home and the first thing I did was like, I'm going to cook bolognese because I've been in the hospital. The hospital food at Epworth's amazing, by the way, but still.
It rotates though.
It does,
so you get to 2 weeks and then you're back on the same
menu. I know. And everyone ended up knowing me because they were like, oh, hey, it's you. I'm like, hello. So I was like, I'm going to make a spaghetti bolognese. So I had still had my hospital ID tags on and I looked like this crazy person walking through Coles. It was peak summer.
Escaped.
I know. My belly was huge. I looked like I was going to, because no one would really know it was twins, like looked like I was going to pop, made spaghetti bolognese, then had a day at home, went in to see my OB and I was having some really bad pain under my breast. And because I had preeclampsia, my blood pressure was elevated and it had sort of risen a little bit higher. And he just said, oh, I don't feel comfortable. We're readmitting you until you have the babies. So that was another call to Nick.
Did you eat the bolognese?
We did. It was a bit overrated, but yeah, I ate it, yeah. So we had that and then so I was readmitted and then I stayed there until I had the babies. The plan was to, if everything was going okay, to wait till 38 weeks. And they were tracking fine with size considering they were twins. But because of the preeclampsia and the waters and stuff, the OB decided as soon as it was 37 weeks, we were going to go into a C-section, which is what we did,
Amazing.
Yeah.
And how was that experience? Did you have a C-section with your first?
I had an emergency C-section with Christian. I was induced for him and, long story short, just things weren't progressing. Mm-hmm. He turned posterior and because I have preeclampsia, I had to have an epidural because my blood pressure was too high. And then they couldn't find his heart rate or anything. He was a bit distressed. And when they did a check, they said he was completely obstructed. So they rushed me in for an emergency, which, as you know, is not a very fun thing
to
deal with. Because obviously it wasn't, you know, a huge amount of time between my next pregnancy, I did want to do a VBAC, but it was not, you know, not advised to do that. And I didn't push it at all with my OB because I knew that he knew what was best for me. I had an elective Caesar with them. Yeah. And the experience was, it was different. Like with the emergency, it's so rushed, so you don't really think about it. But I was actually a little bit more panicked with the elective only because I knew what was going on. Whereas with the elective, you know, they quickly chuck you up, give you the meds, whereas there everything was so calm, but they were like, we're going to do this now and we're going to do that. So I was a little bit more aware and nervous.
Yeah.
And then with the Caesar, everything went well because with my first Caesar, I vomited throughout the whole thing and for 8 hours afterwards, it was horrible. So everything went fine. But then when I went into recovery, things sort of escalated and I actually ended up in ICU that night.
Your blood pressure?
My blood pressure went skyrocketed, crazy. And they were giving me meds and stuff and they couldn't actually really bring it down. So the decision was made that I was going to be moved to an ICU unit, which was actually a different hospital, and that
goodness.
I have to say goodbye to the twins. And it was the best decision.
Did the twins go to special care?
They did that night just because I couldn't care for them.
Yeah.
So apart from that, they were actually fine. They were healthy weights, you know, they were breathing okay, but they had to go to special care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so you were separated.
I was separated from them, yeah, which I still it's hard to process because I think because I didn't really connect with the first pregnancy and I didn't get the experience that I was hoping for. I was vomiting throughout the Caesar. I didn't get to do much skin to skin. Mm-hmm. I had midwives expressing me because I couldn't breastfeed. Yeah. And then even when I went back to the ward, I was vomiting for 8 hours. So I couldn't do anything. With the twins, I was so excited to have them, you know, on my chest and have that experience. And, you know, I did get to do a bit of that, in recovery. I was in recovery for four and a half hours or something. Wow. But there were so many people in the this tiny room coming in and out. And then I just, I was okay at the time, but then once things sort of started to settle in and I started feeling quite sick and I felt like I was paralyzed. I was so tired from everything that they had given me that I could hear everything they were saying, but I couldn't move and I couldn't open my eyes. And they, I just remember one of the midwives saying, kiss your twins goodbye because the ambulance is here and you're going now. Yeah. And so, yeah, that was pretty horrible.
Horrendous.
Yeah.
And how long were you in ICU for?
Just for one night. Okay. Yeah, it was obviously the best decision made for me. At the time, I wasn't thinking about me because I was sort of feeling okay. I think it was adrenaline. Mm. But once I actually realized how serious it could have been, and I think my blood pressure went over 200. It was at one stage, it was quite high. So it was just one night, but, you know, I was sort of calling them, but it was just like these, the midwives are so lovely. And I had actually met the special care team because I was in the hospital for 2 weeks beforehand. Mm. They were taking me to the special care nursery just to be prepared because they said, you're having twins, you're probably going to end up there anyway.
So we don't really know why preeclampsia necessarily happens, and nor do we know necessarily how to fully prevent it. I mean, you talked about aspirin and calcium, and we tend to give that to women early on in pregnancy to try to prevent it. But eclampsia is basically basically like an epileptic fit. That's what eclampsia is. But preeclampsia is a constellation of symptoms and also signs. So things that can happen to you, you feel, or alternatively, we as doctors or midwives can actually see when we examine you. And also some features that we can pick up either on blood film or alternatively urine. So high blood pressure is one of them. In fact, the diagnostic criteria really is to have high blood pressure. That's any blood pressure that's more than 140 or 90. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you know, if you get headaches, spots in the vision, if you get
upper right quadrant
upper
pain.
Right pain up where
the,
where the liver is, if there's any disturbance in your blood film, platelets, which help with clotting, they start to decrease. If your blood starts to hemolyze, so break open, your red blood cells start opening up. These are all features of preeclampsia, and of course also protein in the urine. So you obviously had this bumbling preeclampsia that had gone on, but you were close to having eclampsia.
Yeah.
I mean, you were, you know, a, what they used to say, a bee's whatever,
yep.
just away from having preeclampsia. Because once your blood pressure is over 160, really getting to 160, 180, over 110, so the first number is really, really high, you're at risk of having a stroke. I mean, that's how significant it is. So it's almost like that seizure was timed spot on to give the babies the enough time for them to be mature, but then also for you not to end up having an eclamptic fit because, yeah, you're right. I mean, you needed to go to the intensive care to have that blood pressure dropped with lots of medication to get it under control.
And it was within like an hour. As soon as I came, like it's like as soon as I was cut open and they took the twins out, it just happened. Yeah. And it was hard because obviously my mum sort of knew what time the seizure was and she knows that you're only in recovery for an hour and she still hadn't really heard from us. So I was trying to say to Nick, just let her know we're okay, but I'm, you know, something's going on with my blood pressure. And of course, mum, you know, jumped on Dr. Google and she's like, oh my God, you know, I know you're at risk of stroke and all of these, you know, things. And but at the time I wasn't thinking like that. I was just trying to, you know, I had so many people checking in with me and asking, you know, do I feel this? Do I feel that? And I'll try and breastfeed the twins. I was doing, you know, I was tandem breastfeeding at the same time. I had a million people coming in and out.
Meanwhile, your blood pressure's
it was going over and it was right behind me. And I remember just sort of looking every time they did a reading, I was curious. So I looked and they're like, don't look at it. You need to relax. And I was like, you guys are all talking about it. It's very impossible for me to relax right now.
So obviously getting back onto the ward after ICU, blood pressure presumably normalized.
It was normalizing, but I did have to stay in hospital. I was working with a physician that they sent from the ICU who was looking after me, and she was checking in every day. I had to actually stay in hospital a little bit longer than the normal five nights or four nights for a seizure. I think I was in there just for over a week or so. And then I actually got sent home with blood pressure medication, and I was doing readings three times a day, and I had to email the physician.
In all your spare time.
In my spare time. Well, we also had to move house for 2 weeks.
Wow.
So every day I was emailing her, and then she would let me know. I was still taking the blood pressure medication because it was still at 140 or whatever. And then it eventually, got back to normal. Yeah.
Wow. Cool. And so you go home, you've got twins, you've got a toddler. What was that like?
Oh, it was crazy. It was crazy. It was just...
Does it feel vague? Like for me, even just with a single child,
yeah.
I feel vague about her newborn days.
Like a blur?
Like, but just so blurry. Yeah. Sleep deprivation, hormone. I don't know what went on then.
For me, the sleep deprivation wasn't the worst part. And that's only because I've always been a horrible sleeper.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of used to, you know, no sleep.
Yeah.
The thing that I wanted to make sure when we got home was, because I'd already had the mum guilt of, I was rushed into hospital 3 weeks before. I wasn't spending any time with Christian. I wasn't getting to do the things that I wanted to do one-on-one before these twins came. So I wanted to make sure when we came home that Christian's life was going to remain, in his eyes, unchanged, even though it was very changed.
Yeah.
And so I still wanted to make sure he was still going to his activities, his gymaroo, his swimming, going to see his friends, his park, the play dates.
Mm.
It just looked a little different. You know, Nick was having to take him or my parents or, you know, other people that we had around. But it was utter chaos. And I just felt like I was just stuck at home breastfeeding these twins. And within a week we had to move house as well. So I was trying to juggle that. And it was a lot. Honestly, the 6 months have been a blur.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
And tomorrow you've got their christening.
And I've got their christening tomorrow, yeah.
And they're only 8 months.
I know.
And you're here.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
It's funny because I was having a little bit of a meltdown this morning just because I was enough. I've got to do this, I've got to do that. You know, I've got the podcast tonight. And mum's like, that's you, but you always get it done and you stress yourself out. But if there's anyone that can do it, you know, it's you. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
To other people who have or are going to have multiple under two or a very young family, multiple children, what is kind of a tip or what's something that's helped you?
Well, the first thing I would say, and I'm sure everybody says it, is get your village.
Yeah.
And it is easier said than done. You know, some people don't have a village around. They might have family away. But with social media and stuff these days, you can, like, I'm part of so many groups on Facebook. You know, I'm part of a group from when I had Christian. I'm part of a fraternal twins group, a multiple birth group, like, and I've made friends through mothers groups and all of that. And, you know, that would be my first thing, is just try and find people around you, because you know, I'm not one to actually like accepting help, but, you know, I've learned that I have to. And another thing, I guess, would be, which is something not many people talk about, is the mental load, right? To talk about it with your partner. Because I remember at the start, like, I just felt like the whole, everything was on me. And Nick is an amazing dad. Like, he goes to work, he works quite long hours, and he jumps straight into dad mode. I mean, as he should. But, you know, he is very involved. But there were things like his mental load and my mental load are very different.
Oh, remarkably.
Yeah. Like, I don't mean to say that in a sexist way, but he thinks about work and coming home. When we spoke about this, well, what's your mental load? I come home, I think about work and the meetings I have and providing for the family and, you know, financial support. And whereas mine was looking a little bit different. Also, like, when we go out, I've got to pack the bags and just little things like that. And just
exactly what my wife says.
Yeah, just it's stressing. So like, you don't have to think about packing for three kids and what, you know,
I know,
and food.
Yeah,
what are they going to eat? You know, and now they're on, it's different. They were on milk, but, you know, all of that. And so early on, we sat down and we sort of spoke about our mental load. And even the other day, you know, I was feeling quite stressed, and he said to me, talk to me about what's going on. How can I help? I'll take off some of your mental load. Maybe we can switch a little bit. I'll think about this, you think about that. And I guess just that would be another thing, is communication with your partner is very important. I know everyone says it, but it is, you know, it is key, especially because for Nick and I, our life changed in 2 years. We went from just us to three kids, and it's been a massive change on our relationship as well. And also my final thing would be, with a toddler, try and spend just at least 10 minutes a day just to fill their cup. And that's what someone had told me, and I, you know, sometimes I fail at it. Other days I'm good and I can just spend 10 minutes. But just that quality one-on-one time, I still have mum guilt. Oh, I didn't get to take him to the park today. I didn't spend hours reading a book. But all he needs is 10 minutes of one-on-one to know that, you know, you're still his mum, you're there, you love him, you care. And, yeah, that would be my advice.
They're beautiful tips.
Yeah. So with eight embryos sitting there waiting patiently, are we going to donate them to science? Are we going to donate them to another couple? Are we going to think about a fourth?
No. I never thought I would say this, but I'm like, if I can handle three, I can handle four.
Oh my
god! So I want another. I want a fourth, but Nick is done.
You're
Nick
amazing.
Is actually done. He only wanted two.
Yeah.
So to get three, and I remember when we walked out of the OB clinic, he said, "If this was our third baby and found out it was twins," he said, "I wouldn't be happy with you." So for now, they're just going to stay put. They're going to stay. Well, there's six left. They're going to stay frozen. Yeah. I just feel like I worked so hard to make these beautiful embryos. I don't want to get rid of them just yet. So
yeah.
But there's not another kid coming because I know family's going to be listening to this. Yeah.
No more. We're all done.
No
more babies. Yeah. You're off babysitting duties, Mum.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much for sharing.
No
that.
Worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Unique and incredible journey. And yeah, absolutely. Astounding, to
Thank
be
you.
Honest.
Thanks for having me, getting
made
me out of bedtime.
I'm exhausted just
I know, holy moly. It's
Can you see the bags? Yeah.
Oh, God, no. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Baby Baking and Kid Raising. If you'd like to suggest a guest or connect and see more of us, then head to Instagram at Baby Baking and Kid Raising. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd be so grateful if you could hit subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever listening platform you use.
Please note that the information provided in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of a qualified healthcare provider regarding your own pregnancy, birth, and health conditions.